episode of We the People Radio. I'm Marge Simpson.
Oh, no. Marge, are you back?
Stay at the fair all week. You can sound like Marge Simpson, too. Well, Bill, who's our sponsor this hour?
Yes, my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape has a wide range of tractors and mowers and implements to choose from. Go by and see them. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake. And they also do service parts, and they can work on anything. Just give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226, or you can catch them on the web at papemachinery.com. There you go.
2269226. I know that by heart now.
Yeah, you're doing good.
3119 Twin View Boulevard. I can do it kind of in the rain, like in the rain.
What'd you say?
Motif.
What'd you say? What address was it?
Isn't it 3119 Twin View?
31. I thought you said 32.
Oh, no, 3119.
Yeah, 31.
And the Gorton's Fisherman thing is fixed,
yeah.
So it's a big banner that says John Deere.
We had to take his fishing coat away and put up a new banner, so.
Oh, my goodness. What's the other thing? Oh, we saw our friend Wayne Facca at the fair, and Wayne missed our free commercial that we did.
He did?
Yeah. You better do it again.
Yeah. I can. I don't have a. We'll do it bottom of the hour.
Okay. All right.
Give him a little promo.
We'll do that. And, we saw a bunch of people who listen to the program all the time. Kay and her sister stopped by the booth. And so we got a lot of feedback from people in real life. It was fun. So if you have ideas and guests or, people you've written cool books or, I don't know, just people you'd like to hear more from, you can always find us at WeThePeopleRadio.com. US. Our phone numbers and email addresses are on there. If you want to call me at 4 o'clock in the morning and leave me a lewd message, though, that's kind of not that.
Yeah, that's not cool.
You could skip that.
If you are going to do it, do it on a
block line.
On a block line, not one that has your name on it. That's not cool.
Yeah, 401 drunk dial without blocking your number. Anyway, good times. Good times for everyone. So let's see. We are talking about inflation this hour. How timely. Our friend Stephen Manfredi, the publicist from Virginia, I believe. He is the Manfredi Strategy Group. He is the greatest. He's always sending us somebody interesting. And Liam is our new engineer. Hello, Liam.
Hello.
Hi. So do we have Mr. Lewis on the phone?
We do not, no.
Oh, we do not. Okay.
I haven't gotten a phone call, but...
Did you call him?
No, I didn't.
It's right there on that post-it note, right by your right hand.
I'm very sorry about that. Let me give him a call. Okay,
you're
guys.
Brand new. We get it. We'll just keep stalling for time.
Thank you.
It's because we were at the fair all week, which is why I have the Marge Simpson voice. So let's see. Let's do a little bit about Mr. Lewis so we don't blow time just doing that while he's on the phone. So the book, it's about a book. It's called Inflation. What is it? Why is it bad? And how to fix it. Written by Steve Forbes, Nathan Lewis, and Elizabeth Ames. So, about Steve Forbes, everybody's heard of him. Nathan Lewis, he's among the world's world's leading authorities. Totally different from least. Leading authorities on monetary policy and economic history. He's the author of The Magic Formula, The Timeless Secret to Economic Health and Prosperity, Gold, The Once and Future Money, Gold, The Financial Times, The Monetary Polaris, and Gold, The Final Standard. So he writes on gold a lot. That is really a big topic for him. A Discovery Institute fellow, his writing has appeared in Forbes, the Financial Times, and elsewhere. Publishes the Polaris Letter, a monthly investment newsletter available at newworldeconomics.com. And I've linked all that up on the website. Pretty darn great. So, he's on there with us, eh?
Hello.
Hey, how are you? I'm sorry, Liam's in there doing hand signals and trying to write down a thing. Sorry about that, buddy. you can just shoot me a message on Skype. We can secretly talk on Skype. That'll be easy. We have a new engineer this week. He is taking over, and so we have not worked with or met him before. So, Mr. Lewis, I just gave everybody your little 411 there. You are obviously an expert on gold. It's unfortunate we're not talking about that today, but let's do that in the future, for sure. But inflation is the timely topic. I don't know where you'd like to start with this, but we would be happy to follow along because I think people are getting a lot of mixed messages on inflation.
Yeah, where's it coming from? What happened?
Good question. I did write a few books about gold. I call it the Gold Trilogy. It's not necessarily about investing in gold, although that's in there. It's mostly about the history of and the practice of using monetary systems based on gold, which we did for almost 200 years in this country up until 1971, and as long as we stuck with that principle, never had an inflation problem. So it is actually related to our topic today. The newest book I have out with co-author with Steve Forbes and Elizabeth Baines, it is called Inflation. And we decided that we should write it because we could see that there was going to be a problem. And also, just been our experience over the last, throughout all of our lifetimes, but certainly the last 20 years, that just as you can see, there's a lot of confusion on this topic. And what happens when there's confusion is you just get bad responses and ineffectual responses, and it's big mess. And you don't have to know all that much about economics to kind of smell that's sort of what's going on right now.
And they're just making stuff up. Oh, inflation isn't. It's two things. It's kind of funny. On the one hand, they're telling us there is no inflation, and then they're saying it's actually not bad.
Transitory.
Oh yeah, yeah. Are we still talking transitory, or did we give that up already?
I don't think they totally give it up.
I think transitory is blown up in their face between gas and the price of food.
There actually was some rationale behind it, although it was wrong. So what we decided in the book, which we wrote for really the normal people, right? It's not for policy wonks. It's not for economists, although they could learn something, can we hope? and one of the problems is just this word, just this term, inflation, it kind of arises from popular speech. It's not really like from economists to the general public. It's kind of like the other way. And it's just become this catch-all, this stew pot of all kinds of things that might cause prices to rise broadly. And as a result, you end up talking about everything. Well, it's Federal Reserve, no. It's Vladimir Putin, no. It's the housing shortage. You just go around and around like this. And so what we really wanted to do in the book is, first we decided that we were going to break this down into two basic categories of macroeconomic processes or cause and effect mechanisms. And one is what we call non-monetary factors. And this is all the supply and demand factors that you can point a finger at. And we're having a lot of those these days. All the supply chain stuff kind of came out of COVID and long-standing things and things related to the energy sector and all these things, and we've talked about them, very tight labor markets, and sometimes the government is involved in these by creating problems one way or the other. And those really don't have anything to do with the currency per se, right? You could have a supply and demand issue without having, a currency issue. And usually in the past, we've seen this during wartime. During World War II, prices went up a lot because everyone was using everything in wartime, and fewer people making things because they're all out fighting. And you saw this also after the end of World War II when price controls were lifted and prices all jumped up like 20% in the next couple of years. Not really had that much to do with the currency. And we can kind of understand that. And that's definitely happening now, and it's really more acute than at any time since maybe World War II, so it's a little weird that way. And then we decided there's a whole another category. There's really just one factor, which is the monetary factors. And this has nothing to do with supply and demand. There's no shortages or surpluses or anything of that sort. It's just the currency. It's just the management of the currency by the central bank, or mismanagement, if you want to think of it that way. And it's really easy to understand, although this is almost never talked about. You never hear this discussed. But it's really easy to understand. It's simply a decline in the value of the currency. And in the old days, this was common when the kings would reduce the silver content of the coin. So Henry VIII, you might remember in the 16th century, King of England, during his reign, the silver content of the coinage of Britain fell from 90% silver to 30% silver. So I had one-third of the amount of silver. Guess what happened to prices in Britain? They went up three times, just like you would expect. And that was the old-fashioned way of doing things. Now we kind of have, you know, our currencies are very virtual. We have paper bills, of course, but then even a lot of sort of digital stuff. And this is kind of happens in a virtual way, but it's really just a decline in the currency. And we've had these declines ever since we left the gold standard in 1971. I actually estimate the value of the dollar today, at least compared to gold, is actually about 1/50th of what it was worth in the 60s. We actually have a 2-cent dollar. CPI doesn't quite say that, but I think that's actually what's going on. And just as the long-term trend has been toward declining currency value over time, so too, we had another episode in that long sordid tale when central banks got very busy during COVID in 2020. They actually created quite a lot of money out of nowhere. The money supply increased by quite a lot in their response to that. Just as you might expect, when there's a lot more of something, its value may decline, and it did decline. And when that happens, prices all adjust over time to compensate, just like Henry VIII. Doesn't happen overnight, but over months and years afterwards, the prices rise higher to adjust for the new value of the currency, and that's what also is happening right now.
Yeah, because I think everybody is talking about the amount of money that's been pumped into the economy in the last couple of years, actually longer than that, but this flooding of the economy of free money and no labor, I think everybody knew eventually that was going to catch up with us. And is that what's happening?
Essentially, yes. It's a little – there have been times in the past over the last 10 years when there has been an apparent – increase in the money supply, and real, it's not just apparent. But there wasn't that much decline in currency value that resulted. So they're kind of all sitting around like, oh, well, you know, what's going on? So you have to understand that as a process of supply and demand, like any market, resulting in a decline in the value, which I think did happen in 2020, and actually late 2019. So yeah, that's basically the process that's gone on. And it's pretty easy to understand, really. But you don't hear it described very accurately, even among the expert class.
Okay, if you had to pick the one thing that just makes you want to, you know, shoot your television set about inflation, what is it? I would imagine there are a lot of options here.
Yes. Well, the monetary side of inflation is the most persistent because that is kind of, if you just imagine it, if the value of your money goes down, then doesn't the value of your wages go down? Doesn't the value of your savings account, your bonds, pension obligations, you know, benefits and everything go down? Yeah, it does. It makes you poorer. But you don't, and we all can see this happening. It's happening to us. But you never really hear about this. And the traditional solution in the past was, yeah, just don't do that. Keep the currency stable in value, which we used to do before 1971. We kept the currency stable versus gold. That's the way we did it. But we don't want to give that up, right? We've institutionalized this thing where, no, we don't have a currency of stable value. You have a currency that declines in value from time to time. There's some kind of crisis. There's a recession. There's something happens. And we get yet another step down in currency value with the same old result. And now it's kind of institutionalized, right? Now they say, oh, yeah, we want continuous inflation. We want 2% a year. Not a lot. Everyone gets angry at us. But we have this sort of long-term deterioration of our – we don't have stable currency. We have this long-term deterioration in the value of our currency. And that's something that we never talked about.
Do you think, in light of the influx of money and so forth with the central banks, have we hit kind of the bottom as far as inflation goes? Do you think it's going to go higher yet, or are we still or have we stabilized?
Well, that's a good question, and of course, there's a lot of, you know, people are trying to guess this. I would say that for now, so we have this big bump up in essentially money supply, very aggressive response during 2020 when kind of everything was going haywire during COVID. And then by the early 2021, they kind of realized it went overboard, and they didn't really want to take it back because that could, they thought that would probably be a recession. But they said, you know, okay, no mas, right? Let's just hold the line here, not do any more stupid stuff. And so actually in the last couple of years, although the effects of that sort of decrease in the currency and the effects of that burst of money creation are now being felt today, there's a time lag. But in the last year and a half or so, I would say, the Federal Reserve and other central banks worldwide have actually been pretty responsible. You know, they've taken a much more cautious stance. They don't want to build upon the prior error. So that's kind of where they are now. And if they continue to do that, then things will probably abate. And a lot of these supply chain issues and other non-monetary factors I was talking about, in the past, they've gone away pretty quickly. I mean, when in your life have car dealerships had no inventory on the lot?
Yeah, right? No kidding.
That never happens, right?
And not only had no inventory, no new inventory. I mean, they've got no new inventory, and then they've got, like, some old stuff, and you're like, what the heck?
Yeah, we've never seen that before, or at least in modern times.
Now, if you live in a town for a long time, you kind of know who has what. And you, like, this one car lot here in town, we were sitting there at the stoplight, and you look over, and the cars are just getting spread farther apart. It's like, oh my gosh, look over there. Because, like, it looks the same, but then when you really look at it, you're like, wait a minute, they have, like, half the cars. They're just, like, everybody's got, you know, they could open the doors in both cars, and they would, like, not actually hit each other. Not awesome. I'm thinking, what a bad day to be a car guy.
Yeah.
Nathan, we've got to take a really quick break, and then we'll be right back. I found the perfect song for your book, though. We'll come back with that in case you ever make it a musical or anything. I think the Gatlin brothers got you covered.
All right.
We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
That's a whole new topic there.
Yeah, that's a whole different topic.
Let me tell you.
The train wreck of train wrecks. But yeah, you know, in just case you make it a musical, there are, you know, some good gold songs out there. Hey, Nathan, I was looking at this one, the one clip that Stephen had highlighted, and he said, inflation argues that the best way to end inflation and spur economic growth is through a return to the sound dollar anchored by gold. It kind of goes from there, but...
Is that even possible?
And what would that look like? Like, what would it do?
I think there's a lot of misconceptions about it. I'll make it real simple for Americans, your listeners. Like I said, I wrote three books about gold standards. We did this for almost two centuries up until 1971, so
right.
It was possible. Got really wealthy doing it. And the last decade, the 1950s, there was no problem. It was one of the most prosperous decades of the last century. So it worked in the past. But say, oh, we can't do that now. Well, obviously there's political issues, but you got to get Congress to pass or whatever. But in practice, all it really means is that you keep the dollar stable versus gold. Well, there are actually over 100 countries today that keep their currency stable typically versus the euro or the dollar. And the IMF actually banned the gold standard. Those countries are actually banned by the IMF from linking their currencies to gold. So they kind of we'll link to the dollar. And so what they're doing today is basically what we used to do. We said, well, no, we don't want our, you know, local homegrown central banker kind of making stuff up as he goes along, and we have this floating fiat currency that the short-term value is uncertain and the long-term value keeps on going down. Well, we don't want that because many of the countries used to have that. We're just going to link the value of our currency to some reasonably reliable, external, definite standard, U.S. dollar, gold, and hope for the best, because it works in.
And hope for the best.
Well.
Yeah, sure.
And we can't predict the future, but something that works in the past for hundreds of years, usually, you know, it don't work okay. And that's really all there is to it. You know, if countries can do it today, linking their currency to the euro, why can't we link to gold? Yeah, basically, we can, you know, without getting into all the... I wrote books about the details. You don't want the whole details. But, yeah, it's not that hard. And the results are great for business. What it would do, of course, is it prevents the government or central bank from responding to recessions or other economic challenges with kind of money manipulation. You can no longer manipulate the money. It's just linked to gold. It's done, right? It's like the foot. It has 12 inches. Okay, we got that. We're done, right? And your money is like that. It becomes a stable unit of commerce, just like a foot, just like a meter, like a minute, like a, you know, a kilogram. It's no longer this thing that's being manipulated by some goofballs in Washington, D.C., depending on what yesterday's headlines were. And if you think about that, yeah, you know, that's good for business, right? If we do business, we can just use money the way we use the meter. You know, I want 2 meters of pipe. Okay, great. I'm going to borrow, you know, I'm going to borrow $2,000. Okay, great. And just as you can imagine, things work really well. That's how we became the wealthiest country in the history of the world. And now, if you look at statistics, it kind of looks like the average American worker has kind of gone nowhere since 1970. And, you know, you kind of guess why. So that's the big picture. Absolutely, we can do it when we decide to. And the most important thing for Americans today, because, you know, Congress is not going to pass it tomorrow, but the most important thing, I think, for Americans today is to say, yes, we want stable, the principle of stable money, unchanging money, which we used to do for centuries. We want that. We don't want, you know, whoever it is, Jay Powell, Ben Bernanke's, you know, funny money that he's always, you know, playing games with us with. We don't want that. You got to start with that. You got to start with principles.
I just think that...
So,
okay, go ahead.
I was just... I don't know. There's so many dollars out there now. How much gold would it take to back every American dollar with gold? I mean, that's why I'd say I'm not sure that's even possible anymore.
Basically what you're asking is reserve coverage.
Right.
And at no point, at no time in U.S. history has there ever been 100% backing of dollars. And in fact, before the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, paper money, was actually created by private banks like Wells Fargo. They actually were in the money printing business. And Chase and you know, banks like this. And there are actually over 1,000 of them making their own banknotes, creating the money. And they were redeemable in gold. You go to the counter at the bank, you go to, you know, Wells Fargo at the counter and say, I got some of your banknotes, I want some gold in return. And they would give it to you, just as they do for your bank deposits. But they never had all that much gold in the safe.
Right.
Some people say it was 2% of their outstanding liability, which I think is probably kind of slim. But the point is, this idea that you need, you know, fountains of gold in the vault is not really necessary. In fact, it's never been true. What you need to do is to maintain the value of the currency at the standard. And if you think about it, it's just like your bank deposit, just like your checking account, your savings account, right? We all know there isn't a stack of $20 bills in a vault somewhere that 100% corresponds to the balance in your checking account. We know that, right?
Right. So if we all showed up on the same day...
Well, I don't know. Yeah. My checking account is probably not in there, but...
How would you know? No, you're not in charge of it.
But when you go to the bank and you ask for the withdrawal money in cash, or you go to ATM or most commonly, and you ask to withdraw money from cash, they always deliver, right?
Sure.
And you know, if they didn't have the cash, if they literally didn't have the cash in the vault so they could fill the ATM, what would they do? they borrow it. Well, no, actually, you can do that. You know, the federal government could just get more gold from somewhere else. And, you know, it's not limited. It's not like there's a certain amount that's limited to that for all time. You could just pick some up off the market and give it back to the market just as banks do. And, in fact, central banks and commercial banks did this in the past. So this is like 19th century technology, right? We've done all this. It's not really that complicated.
So back when the dollar was backed by gold, gold was also, it didn't really fluctuate in value very much. I mean, it was like $32 an ounce forever. And then we went off the gold standard, and now what's gold, $1,800 an ounce? Is that, I mean, is that, you think that's a real number that is a real value for gold?
What we have essentially is what is known with economists as the money illusion. So we naturally, money is a human creation. It doesn't, you know, gold is a mineral, but money is something that
right.
humans created. Iron is a mineral, but we create automobiles out of steel. And our ideal of money is something that is, it's our inherent ideal of money is something that is stable in value. And we just assume that it is. So, for example, when we see that the price of gold go from $35 in the 1960s to, about $1,800 today. Did the gold become 50 times more valuable? And I just suggested that it didn't. No, what actually happened, almost all of that, is essentially your dollar losing value. It now takes 50 times more dollars to buy an ounce of gold, not because gold changed, but because your dollar did.
Right.
That's what this process has been. And, you know, a barrel of oil is $3 in the 1960s. Now it's $100. What happens? You know, we still drive gas cars, or we still drive like, you know, Cadillac Escalades and stuff, which is just like the, you know, lifted version of the Cadillac Eldorado from 1965.
Right.
Oil is still fundamentally cheap in some way, or we would have lifted cars. But, you know, essentially just the dollar has lost value over that time. And so much of, can you just imagine if there was some, forget about gold. If there was some perfect, ideal, fantastic standard of unchanging monetary value, whatever that was, like a meter, right? It's just an unchanging value. And the dollar is a floating fiat currency. We all know this. We all know it goes up and down in value. It's supposed to do that. That's what it is. Then the exchange rate between the dollar and that perfect ideal, you know, the meter, would be fluctuating, right? And that's essentially largely what we see in the dollar-gold price.
All right, well, that makes sense.
That's kind of interesting. So, all right, so for people that are looking at where this might go, kind of based on the policy that they've been doing, what do you think is going to happen?
Right, where this might go. So I was getting, before the commercial break, I was kind of getting at, you know, but they're kind of trying to be responsible right now, and so arguably the supply chain issues would be resolved, although it kind of seems like it's worse, not better. But,
yeah.
And then maybe the inflation issue would fade away, kind of like the people are saying. And that's possible. My concern is really, there's really two things. One is seems like we're kind of sliding into recession in here. And what happens in a recession? Haven't we seen this movie before? Doesn't the federal government step up with, like, you know, crazy spending programs?
Yeah.
Doesn't the central bank get busy with all kinds of very, very lax, very easy monetary policies, and in fact even create large amounts of money like they did in 2020? And in effect, although there wasn't a direct connection, indirectly what they did is the Federal Reserve created money to pay for the federal spending programs in 2020. And might that happen again? Even if it's just one third amount as what happened before, isn't that the pattern we've all gotten used to? And if it is, then we're probably, I could say, pretty confident that we're going to have another burst of inflation, and it will be worse than what we've had before.
Well,
now, is that what you would call hyperinflation?
No, that's actually the next topic. So it's just kind of a typical recession response, although it's getting bigger and bigger. Every time we have a recession, the response gets bigger. But we actually have another issue now, that which is actually kind of becoming pretty acute, not just in the U.S., but around the world. And although we have the same factors in the U.S., they're actually worse elsewhere, notably in Japan. And that is, we have a ton of debt, which we built up over time. And we have all these entitlement programs, and, you know, which are causing persistent deficits. And on top of that, now we have some rising interest rates. But the interest rate, the interest cost on the debt held by the federal government, which is really low for a long time, is now galloping higher dramatically because not only do you have more debt, but you're paying more on all each amount of each $1 trillion of debt. And that is looks like it's going to blow out the deficit to 4 to 6%, even without a recession. So we just have, like, you know, 4 to 6%, maybe even higher, 7% deficit all the time. Well, you know, it doesn't take too much of that before governments in the past, other governments, have increasingly relied on the printing press to finance all this. And that's what divides inflation from hyperinflation. The thing that causes prices to go way, way up in a hyperinflation is gigantic increases in the quantity of money. And the gigantic increases in the quantity of money don't come about because people got around table like a bunch of economists and say, you know, I think the best thing to do would be have hyperinflation. Right? That never happened. What happened is they had to pay some bills, and they created the money to pay the bills. And we're getting a lot of governments around the world, including us in the United States, are get kind of going down that path. And it's not, we're not really that far from doing that. And I think that's possible in the next 10 years.
No, that is the cycle. I mean, I can see that coming. That they're gonna make another run at printing a whole bunch more money, which is gonna create.
And all the crazy programs, let's create all the free money programs, which, you know, just really cuts the legs out from under private industry. And I mean, in the one part, I don't remember which part of it that I was reading, but your answer was, you know, spur private industry and get economic growth back on track, and then we can solve some of this.
Yeah, and you could, it kind of depends on your outlook. If you could say, well, one of the goals we had for writing the book is like, well, maybe we can avoid that. I kind of think we're not going to change the course of history much, but maybe we can avoid that outcome. But the second reason for writing the book is to say, well, what if all that happened? Then what? Then the thing that comes afterwards. And there have been, as you mentioned in the book, there have been countries in the past that have gotten into hyperinflation. Both Germany and Japan had hyperinflation after World War II. Not during World War II, but actually afterwards when they were under U.S. occupation. In 1949, they would have hyperinflation. So what do? They had a very clear strategy. The first thing they did is they passed a law that the government could not issue any more debt. They could not spend any money unless they previously received the money in the form of tax revenue. So they cut up all the credit cards. Well, that obviously relieved the need to print any money, right? But they had to have this big overhaul of spending. So they did that, and Japan actually kept those laws until 1965. They had 15 years where they did that. And then they fixed the inflation problem by putting the currency back on the gold standard, yen, when yen was linked to gold and the German mark was linked to gold in 1949. So that fixed the inflation problem. And then they reduced taxes a lot. They had huge tax reductions because they said, hey, they were sitting in rubble, essentially.
Right.
Not because of the war, but because of the economic disaster that followed the war, which prevented any rebuilding. And he said, well, we're not going to get any more high taxes. We're going to have to have strong business, so let's cut taxes. And they had huge, huge booms as a result. And if we get into trouble, and we should remember that strategy because it works.
Yeah. For some reason, we're not really good at doing the things that work over and over. We have this evil tendency to do the things that cause a little train wreck. I would be very curious to know. We have to take another quick break, one last one. But I would be very curious to know how you view this, like through the lens of the Jimmy Carter era. because it just sort of feels like we're doing that all over again. And maybe because I was in high school at that time, and I look at some of this and I think, oh my gosh, it's the same deal. Cars were really expensive. We were just getting out of school. I think home loans were in the 20-21% at that time. So here we had gotten our education, we got out of college, and it was like, well, now we can't afford to do anything. All the stuff we planned for, we were basically locked out of at the time. I'd be really curious what you think of that. We'll be right back with our guest, Nathan Lewis. He has written a book with Steve Forbes and Elizabeth Ames. It is called Inflation. What is it? Why is it bad? And how do you fix it?
Story about Billy Joe and Bobby Sue. Two young lovers with nothing better to do. They'd sit around the house, get high and watch a tube. And here's what happened when they decided to cut loose. They headed down to Buell, El Paso. I swear they ran into a great big.
Another hit for the musical. Inflation, the musical. All right, so Nathan, are we in Jimmy Carter times again? Is this going to go kind of that same way?
No, it's actually quite a bit different, and I'll describe.
Am I happy that it's different, or am I sad? Just spoiler alert me. Oh, I'm sad. I could tell. Never mind. Go ahead.
Rip the Band-Aid off.
The short term is I think we're in considerably better position than we were in the late 70s. But in the bigger picture, it's worse. So let me say what I mean. So during the 1970s, the amount of dollars, number of dollars it took to buy an ounce of gold went from 35 in the 1960s, the gold standard. It was kept at 35. To about 350 in the 80s and 90s. So, forget about some of the wiggles. That was kind of the average. So basically, it took 10 times more dollars to buy an ounce of gold. So I suggest what that means is that the dollar lost 90% of its value. We had a 10-to-1 decline of dollar, or it became only worth 10 cents, if you want to put it in those cents. And that's a much bigger move. That's much more serious than what we've had so far. The dollar was about 1,200 in 2018, and now it's about 1,800, so much more of those. And that was really driving all the action that happened in 1970s. Everything was being driven by that. There was really no commodity issue. Commodities actually kind of were laggards. They only went up about 3 times in price. People talked about oil shortages and all this stuff, but that really, they didn't really exist. It was just monetary. The other thing is that there weren't really many deficits in the 70s. The government kind of ran balanced budgets, or what we would consider balanced budgets today. They had a deficit of 1% of GDP or something like that. They thought it was a big deal, but we can hardly notice. And debt-to-GDP ratios in that time were pretty low, at about 30%. So federal government debt-to-GDP was about 30% then, and now it's about 120% or 100% held by the public. So we have much higher debt levels now. So, and we also have these supply chain shortage issues in energy, agriculture, in many, many things, which have resolved themselves in the past, and be getting worse today. But that's kind of new, and it's easy to assume it won't become a big deal, but it keeps getting worse. So that's something. So that's something that's a little new. I cover The Economist as how we're going to run. all this stuff. So that's kind of a new thing. And I think it might persist for a while. But in the bigger picture, we didn't have the other thing that happened is the 1970s is that the central banks, just as there weren't big deficit issues, it actually did not create that much money. Money creation was not a feature of the 70s. The currency fell in value a lot. Like I said, probably about 90%. But there wasn't really that much money printing going on. Now, what we have today is central banks around the world have gotten into this pattern of money printing. And governments have gotten into this, I think, sort of addiction behavior of just assuming that the central bank is going to be there to backstop all their spending. And we have this very high debt level, and we don't seem to have any plan to deal with it except to ignore it and inflate it away. After World War II, we actually had 100% of GDP debt levels at the very end of World War II. But what happened? Well, the federal government cut its spending in half because it wasn't spending on wartime anymore. And it cut taxes, and the economy boomed, and everything was great. We're not doing that, right? I don't see Congress saying, oh, you know, we have the debt problem. Let's cut our spending in half.
Yeah, no.
That's not happening. They're all doubling down, right? We have deficits as far as I can see, and since we might as well have one last party. Let's just spend all the money we can. It is the reaction I'm seeing. And like I said, this is all kind of leading toward repeating the same process. You know, if we might be going into recession, isn't Congress going to spend these boatloads of money on stupid stuff that's a big waste of money?
Yes.
And when that happens, the central bank, even if they're reluctant, will be under a lot of pressure to make all the pain go away by spending money one way or the other. Even though right now they're kind of trying not to do that. I give them some credit for that. And in the bigger picture, you know, it just looks to me, I hate to make these kind of doomsday predictions because they're so often wrong, but it just looks to me like we are ambling down this path toward a hyperinflationary outcome. And one indicator of that recently is Japan is actually far worse off than we are, so we're actually kind of better than most places in the world. But if you look at this, the yen has had this, the currency of Japan has had this like fall out of bed look to it recently. And the central bank and the government is reacting to this by actually stepping up their money creation. It's stepping up their government bond purchases of basically printing money. So it looks like, at least for them, I would not be surprised. It's kind of like that hyperinflationary outcome that people have been talking about for 20 years. Is happening right now. It's not obvious yet, but it started.
Mm-hmm.
And if it started there, then other countries that look kind of similar but are not quite as bad, yeah, but they have all the same symptoms, which would be Europe next and then United States third, we might not be that far from, doing the same sort of thing. So, you know, in three to 5 years, maybe what's happening to Japan might start happening to us.
And then what do you see with the price of gold and silver then in the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, it's just the reciprocal of the currency value. Gold throughout human history, I wrote a book about this going back 5,000 years. It's always been pretty stable in value.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly for the last 500 years, where we have more data, it's been pretty stable in value. That's why it serves as the basis of monetary systems, because it's the one thing in the world that does for money what like a meter or a kilogram does for length and weight. It's reliable. And I think it still has that quality. So if you had this hyperinflationary outcome, if you got to 10,000 or a million or $1 billion per ounce of gold, it's just a dollar. It has nothing to do with gold. Gold is just an inert metal.
Right. Right.
It just measures how much your dollar is worth. We talk about this kind of like $1 billion banknote kind of outcome, but what Latin America experienced in the 1980s, every country south of Texas had hyperinflation in the 80s. The value of the Mexican peso went down by 100 times, went from 27 to 2700 per dollar. So I think an outcome like that is certainly possible.
Because I look at the recent inflation numbers. I mean, the price of everything's going up. It doesn't really seem to have a lot of impact on the price of gold.
No, that happened earlier. That happened in late 2019 and 2020 when the number of dollars it takes to buy an ounce of gold went from 1,200 to about 1,800, so about 50% of it. And just as I mentioned, Henry VIII, so the natural consequence, just kind of all things being equal, you might expect from that, is for prices to rise about 50% as a consequence. It doesn't always work out that cleanly in real life, but that's kind of what we're experiencing now. Your price is rising, let's say, over a period of years, roughly 50% to as an adjustment to that prior event. But right now, actually, like I said, central banks do not seem to be letting their currency depreciate versus gold, except for Japan.
And then what do you see with interest rates? In light of what's happening now, you think the Feds are going to raise interest rates and keep going up like they did in the 70s?
That'll be interesting to see. One of the problems we have now is there's way too much focus on interest rates. And you can just let the market figure out interest rates for itself. And that's what we did in the past. What we want to do is manage and ideally stabilize the value of the currency. You never hear about that. We always hear about interest rates. But what inevitably happens eventually if a currency has a pattern of falling in value is that interest rates have to rise to compensate, right? Investors are not just going to let themselves get devalued to oblivion. Now, I might mention that there is kind of an exception to this rule, and that is if the government steps in and buys the debt, essentially setting interest rates, then you can have very low interest rates in not only inflation, but hyperinflation. And in fact, this is what happened in Germany in the 1920s, early 1920s. You probably heard about that. The interest rate actually was 5%. Now, the CPI was at, 2,800%, but the interest rate was at 5%. And this creates all kinds of weird things.
wheelbarrows of cash.
Yeah, so funny things could happen there. In general, we've had extremely low interest rates. In fact, the interest rates the last 5 years, we had negative rates in Europe, and then we had, after COVID, collapsing rates in the United States. These are actually the lowest interest rates in all of known human history. We have debt contracts going back to 2700 BC and probably some before then. Never have there been interest rates this low.
Yeah.
And it's basically a completely abnormal situation created by central bank intervention. So just to return to normalcy, we're going to have some entire interest rates. So I wouldn't, you just kind of got to expect that and get ready for it. It was very common to have government debt at 6% in the 1990s and then borrowing for a house at 7% or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so we should be prepared for those kind of levels just to kind of get back to normal, I would say.
Well, when the interest rates are as low as they have been, it just tells people don't bother to save any money because there's no, you can't. I remember we were kids, we had a savings account and you actually made money. Now, if you were a kid and you had money in the savings account, you might make a penny every 6 months.
And overall, you lose money when you look at the inflation factor.
Yeah, not a huge incentive.
Yeah, you have to speculate just to stay even, right? Which is very unnatural, very, very, problematic way of running an economy. That's why it doesn't work very well. But there might be some interesting things happening there. Historically, in the past, and in fact, this might be starting to happen right now in Russia, is that one of the reasons why we've had this cycle many, 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 many times. Governments getting off of currency discipline, gold standard discipline, and debasing the coinage, printing money. China had paper money hyperinflation in the 11th century. So we've been doing it for a long time. Not only do governments do the same stupid stuff over and over again, but they also fix things from time to time. And one of the reasons they fix things is that they can issue bonds in gold at low interest rates, historically the lowest possible interest rates. So that might be part of our solution. How are we going to politically get back to gold standard? Well, when no one's going to loan you money unless you pay in gold, to have this real quick.
Get your religion in a hurry.
Okay, we're on the gold standard, buddy.
Exactly.
I'll loan you 100 ounces of gold, and you can pay me 105 back in a year from now. Literally, that's how it works.
Problem solved. Oh my gosh, we are we're about a minute out, and I didn't want to leave without having you promote your newsletter at the newworldeconomics.com. If people sign up for the newsletter, like one a week, 15 a day, like what are we looking at?
No, it's a traditional monthly newsletter with some occasional add-on. And it's hosted by Substack. It's pretty affordable. People often ask me, because I actually have a history of investing and manage money right now. Always asking my investing opinion, so now you can get it. It doesn't cost very much.
That's
NewWorldEconomics.com.
All right. Well, you know, a lot of times when you say, hey, there's a mailing list, and people are like, oh, my God, I don't want any more email. But I was assuming that this was a fairly, conservative number of emails. How about that? We're really grateful that you popped on with us. And
yeah, great information.
Super good information. We hope to speak with you again. And best of luck on the book, Inflation. And our guest has been Nathan Lewis. You can find this later on this afternoon, commercial free at
WeHatefulRadio.us.
To another episode of We the People Radio. It's May the 22nd, 2022, just in case we air this at a later date. And my name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
What do you have for us today, Bill?
Well, our sponsor is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. And right now, you can go down there and have a great selection of John Deere tractors in the yard and ready to go. Mowers are a little slim, but they do have some mowers in stock. Mower season's almost over. I mean, we're ramping up to July or June here, so that'll be the end of that. But anyway, there's still time to go down and get yourself a new John Deere lawnmower. They also do parts and service. They can work on pretty much anything. So go down and see them. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake. Or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at PapeMachinery.com.
And you'll know you are at Pape Machinery when you see the Gorton's fishermen hanging from a wire up there on their sign.
Oh, yeah. We had a little windstorm the other night.
Their John Deere banner ripped off both the ends, but it hung in the middle. And so it just looks like the Gorton's fishermen dangling from a wire.
It looks a lot like a raincoat hanging up there. So you want a little chuckle, go up by five.
Turn right at the raincoat.
Yeah. Look for the raincoat.
Yeah. I saw it last night. I was like, God, it does kind of look like a raincoat. Not good. Yeah, not a good look.
Needs a little repair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's way up there. I mean, how are you going to do it? You gotta call a guy, huh?
You got to call a guy with a lift.
Huh.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. This election thing is like, it's just so far out of control. People have all gone crazy. And you know this. You know I'm telling you the truth. It doesn't matter what team you're on either. They've all just the madness. That's when we call it madness. Crazy isn't
chaos.
Yeah, it's just madness has swept the country. Doesn't matter what you're talking to them about. The madness creeps in. You can talk about food. All of a sudden, madness.
All of a sudden,
Yeah, I'm sure the Gorton's fisherman thing's going to set somebody off, so shouldn't even joke about it. Oh, my gosh. Our guest today is going to unscramble the madness for us, though. That's what he promised. Isn't that great? He didn't tell us anything.
Set the agenda, Aaron.
He didn't tell us anything. I'm just like, okay, good. Marcus is going to unscramble everything. His friend who told me to have him on said he could do anything. So we are counting on that today.
Putting the pressure on or anything.
Well, okay, so let's look at his little bio here since he has not been with us prior. He was a military police officer, so he's a professional with chaos, actually.
He should
be great at that in the U.S. Army. And been involved with the conservative activism and bringing the fight for conservative values to Southern California. California, and well, if you were going to start anywhere, that would be the hardest place.
You know, that's going to be a fight.
Yeah, you should start up here. It's a lot easier. Marcos has been involved with many organizations such as Turning Point USA, the Freedom Foundation, and the Republican National Hispanic Assembly. So he was the president of Turning Point USA chapters and sits on the state board for the RNHA, sure, easy for me to say. He has appeared on OANN, Daily Caller, Fox, Telemundo, Turning Point Live, PragerU, Campus Reform. Really fun. He's been fighting the left and public policy, working on public policy that will save America. And gosh, that's a wide array of things. You could start pretty much anywhere since everything has gone crazy. But he loves the outdoors, takes a lot of pictures, enjoys spending as much time as possible traveling and meeting new people. So that's kind of awesome. He has an associate's degree in communication from Mount San Antonio College and is currently pursuing his undergraduate degree in public relations, Cal State University Fullerton, and committed to fighting for California and conservative values in the Latino community. So this is kind of a, I don't know, like a topic we haven't.
Yeah. Yeah,
like we don't know a lot about it. So, Marcos Zalata Rojas, or well, Rodas.
Welcome, Marcos.
I asked him if he was Zalata or...
Hey, how's it going, Aaron and Bill? Pleasure to be on with you guys today.
I figured it was sort of a potato-potato thing I had to ask him. Like, I'm going to get hung up on this. I know I am.
You're going to get hung up on, all right.
I know.
Yeah.
So many things. So, Marcos, I mean, I kind of really did leave it up to you. I'm curious what's going on down at your end of the state and what you're seeing.
Kind of like you mentioned, it's pretty chaotic right now, and I think it's not isolated to just California. I don't think it's isolated just to the Democrat strongholds like California. It really is nationally chaotic right now, and it kind of comes from a place of losing our sense of who we are as a nation, the values that made us the greatest power in the world, and a president who is kind of lost, if you ask me. And I think that's kind of the idea that everyone's holding right now. We have a lack of leadership, and it trickles down very effectively and can cause a lot of chaos, as you mentioned.
Yeah, being lost is being kind.
Yeah.
I'm trying to keep it good.
Well, you know, it's true. I mean, he's wandering around. You know, he doesn't really know what's going on. But, just when we thought we were thrilled to see the Obama people leave, it's like, oh, they're back. They're all back again. And they weren't good when they were in there.
Yes, and you know, although I do understand there is chaos, I mean, people are struggling with the inflation, people are struggling with the fact that our representatives can send money to foreign nations while we're struggling at home. I understand there's a lot of struggle. I mean, hey, I'm not immune to those struggles. I absolutely feel those struggles and the pains that are coming with this current economy under this administration. But I will say this. I believe there's a lot to be hopeful for. I truly is. I am an optimist at heart. I try to be able to, keep marching forward, and kind of roll with the suck, as they used to say in the military. And I think if anything out of the president's current administration is that it's so bad, it will turn more people Republican. And that is something I am very grateful for. Amongst all the bad that they're doing.
I think so, too, because honestly, when I was in high school, it was Jimmy Carter. And this is every bit, except for the gas lines. We haven't gotten there yet, but this is Jimmy Carter.
No, we haven't got there yet because people don't have any money left to get in the line for gas.
But we took a huge swing right after that. So
yes, we did.
I don't know.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's already happening. I mean, just last year, from January to June, Democrats had a 32-point advantage in Hispanic American party identification. So Hispanic Americans were voting Democrat by a 32-point advantage. Now, when they looked at July through December, it's only a 28-point advantage going Democrat. And I think that will continue to sink if President Biden doesn't get it together and the Democrat Party realizes instead of identity politics, they need to actually have policy that has substance in it that helps the American people. And that's from Reuters. And I mean, Latinos or Hispanics, better said, are account for 19% of the U.S. population. And I can tell you very confidently that Latinos are not leftists. They're not communists. They are not Democrats. They simply have been lied to, and the current administration is making them wake up. And with the right activism, the right messaging with the Republican Party, a lot can be done here to capitalize on their mistakes.
It's interesting. So when you, speak to different groups and they say, and let's just say they think that the Democrats are totally on their team, where do you start? Like, where do you start to unscramble that for them?
Well, I think the best thing we can do is find the common ground. So, especially when I talk to Latinos, I'm also involved with Turning Point USA, although today I speak just on my own behalf. It's about finding the common ground. I think most people want to be able to know that they'll have a job next month, that they'll be able to get baby formula for their children, that they'll be able to put food on their tables. And you can break down these policies that are actually affecting them at home, right? The dinner, top conversation. So when they're talking about these things, they're not as polarizing as most people believe. Now, of course, I do have a mindset that, listen, if there are far left leftists who are, of a fundamental idea that America is bad and everything about it is bad and the Republicans are devils walking amongst the earth, you're not going to save that person. At that point, you might as well just go find someone else who can cancel out their vote. But when you can find the common ground and talk about things that matter, most people start to realize that our values and our ideas align, right? Conservatives want a limited government so we can have a better economy with more jobs and less restrictions. They want a more involved government, but ultimately still want good jobs and a better economy which they can thrive in. And then it comes down to sometimes fundamentally, is it the government's job to give you that? Or is it the government's job to get out of the way so that way it can be the best it can be through the free markets? And it's just little things like that where you can start changing people's minds. And when it comes to students, I mean, it's not as bad as people think. I mean, don't get me wrong. Nationally, it's very bad for students right now. I am in thick of it. Believe me, I've been attacked by my universities, institutions, my students. I mean, death threats, you name it. But that's all right, because at the end of the day, nationally, nearly 4 out of 10 young people aged 18 to 29 voted for President Trump. And that's almost halfway there. And we can keep going, because I can tell you right now, after COVID-19, when people experience what it felt like to be stepped on by the government, what overreach and tyranny felt like, a light bulb moment happened. And they realized, okay, a big involved government who tells them what to do, probably not a good idea. And they wanted that individual liberty by giving them a taste of what it's like when it's taken away. So, again, I am hopeful.
Yeah, I thought about that, what the young people were thinking or what they thought the whole restrictions on COVID, what their final thoughts on that were.
Well, down there, it was bad, too.
Yeah,
down where you are was really...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I can tell you right now that in the liberal strongholds that are our universities in America, most students wanted a vaccine mandate. Most students wanted to force others to wear masks. When the Turning Point chapter that I lead at Cal State Fullerton attended a freedom rally, they talked about spraying us with vaccine mist in their internal...
Oh, my gosh.
We had access to. So they're talking about basically what's, symbolically chemical warfare against those who think mandates are bad, right? And that's just what it is. But when you were talking to the normal students, and all due respect to them, they might be very great people. They just hold very wrong ideas and don't act the right way about them. But when you were talking to the moderates, the people who weren't really sure about politics yet, because all they hear about is your professors just spit out all this, trash in their classrooms. When you talk to them and you really present ideas like, hey, do you think it's okay for any governing body to tell you anything about what medication you should insert in your body? And, you bring up the irony. What happened to my body, my choice? If you believe in that, how does this not equate to that? And, again, the light bulb moments happen. So regular people were against it. And, unfortunately, some students were just too afraid to stand up or didn't even know they had other options. So I know of many students who got the experimental COVID-19 vaccine because they thought they had to, without knowing there was exemptions and that there was people who would fight to make sure that they got their exemptions, like myself and many organizations like Turning Point USA.
Wow. Well, the
it was a somber time.
I would imagine in the Hispanic community, the whole abortion thing is a big deal as well.
It is.
I can't imagine that they're in favor of that. That just seems culturally
opposite.
Doesn't seem to fit.
There's been many articles that have been written about the fact that Latinos are very conservative, right? Where we come from religious backgrounds, we believe in family units, we believe in being pro-life based on our own morals as well as our strong background in religion. And we don't agree with the leftist ideas of killing your child out of inconvenience. And we truly believe in constitutional rights and making the America dream happen for ourselves like it has for others. We don't scream at the moon and say, why is America racist? Everything's against me. No. They buckle down.
But that's so popular right now. It's incredibly popular right now.
Exactly.
How are you ever going to get any followers if you don't do that? I mean, everybody knows that's how it works.
Exactly.
Oh, my gosh. We have to take a really quick break. You know what? I just solved the debt crisis because I found out where all the money is. It's down by Marcos.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a whole song about it and everything.
Huh.
So we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
All the gold in California is in a bank in the middle of Beverly Hills in somebody else's name. So if you're dreaming about California, it don't matter at all where you played before. California's a brand new game.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over, but
I'm thinking that song is like an all-purpose song, but that's mostly leftists. So they've moved into our neighborhoods. They've taken over our towns. Do you deal a lot with the college students, Marcos? Is that what's your primary audience?
I've had a lot of years of activism on the college front. You know, with Turning Point USA, I mean that's the trenches right there.
Right.
We're fighting the culture war with a sense of urgency, trying to change minds and convince people of what the right way forward is every single day. And I can tell you right now, we have faced so many threats, backlash, doxing, I mean, you name it. It's as bad as you can imagine. It's just like that.
Mm-hmm. Do they show up like that? Or like, do you see a difference between like a freshman class and a senior class? I realize you know,
truthfully, yes. I do see a transition. The longer you're in that echo chamber of leftist waste, it turns you into a different person. It truly does. So our happiness comes from getting to people sometimes when they're freshmen, sophomores, or juniors who are still reasonable, and sometimes seniors who just realize this whole time that something wasn't right. And that's where the happiness comes from, when you convince people, hey, this is the way forward, or hey, you hold these ideas, it's time to be outspoken. And it's a good time, even with all the negative leftists all around you.
Well, yeah, because I wonder, you know, when you come from home, you might be a little bit ideological, but typically, unless your parents are pretty hardcore into politics, which the bulk of people are not, it seems like you're going to show up at college and it's going to be a new place and you're kind of excited and it seems like you might have a shot at those folks. Any difference between boys and the girls?
I have noticed that it does follow similar trends that have been found through studies that women do seem to have a more left-leaning political ideology.
Yeah, I wonder about that.
I mean, don't get me wrong. The men on universities are not the men I served with, that's for sure. And they do lean very far left. They're not, let's say, you know, they're not a man's man, to say the least.
They're not army material.
But it does follow the trend where men do slightly hold more conservative values. But I can tell you right now, our Turning Point chapter at Cal State Fullerton and many others that I've noticed nationwide, I have amazing friends. It is led by amazing conservative women. And I have found that conservative women are actually some of the best fighters in the movement. Even though nationally women may lean more left, the conservative women are absolute fighters, and they're at the very front lines.
Yeah, we saw that like with the Tea Party, you know, like 12 years ago. A lot of the groups wound up being really propelled by women. But I'm thinking on a college campus, I think girls sometimes go into that fuzzy bubble of, you know, ideological silliness. And I'm not sure men ever really escape from the idea of I'm going to have to grow up and earn a living. Like they can't marry someone who's going to earn a living for them.
Right. That is true. Yeah, that value and that view is still there.
I think in the back of their head, they're like, I still have to go out. I can't get that lesbian studies degree I was thinking about because that's going to make me unemployable.
Right. I actually need to put food on the table somehow.
Well, I think there's just got to be a tremendous amount of pressure on kids when they hit the college campus with you know, like you were saying, the indoctrination, you know, 8 hours a day, it'd be pretty easy for them to just kind of go with the flow, and then the next thing you know,
we're on the team, we're wearing a pink hat and marching in the streets.
There you go.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's terrible. I've had a American studies professor who was teaching a class on the American dream, which I, as a conservative, as a patriot, was, hey, okay, I want to learn this academically. Let's see what this is about. Knowing that there was a 50-50 chance to be a leftist teaching the course, and unfortunately it was. And on the first day of class, the professor said that America isn't that great, and it's pretty much not different from anywhere else in the world. Everyone has similar rights. We're not unique in that sense.
Oh, wow.
And I quickly disagreed. And I always joke around that it probably knocked me down a grade or two, but it is worth it. And it's just crazy the type of indoctrination to the level they go.
Yeah, that's...
I've had students tell me that they had to take privilege quizzes. And
you had to take a what?
A privilege quiz, which is a questionnaire that calculates how privileged you are depending on your income. Majority of the time it's because of the pigmentation of your skin. So if you happen to be a little bit lighter, you're more privileged. If you're darker, you're underprivileged and a victim.
Oh, wow.
And they use the worst or the most privileged persons as an example. And that happened to be one of my students who came forward with that. And she felt embarrassed. She felt attacked. She did not grow up wealthy. She just happened to be half white and half Hispanic. But because she's half white, she's an oppressor. Because, of course, the university is prescribed to the ideas of critical race theory, and it's unfortunate. And one of the scariest things to me is not so much that it's happening in the colleges, but people don't realize how early it's starting to happen now. This is going on in elementary schools across the world as well. The U.S. has become an exporter of these bad ideas, of critical race theory, this idea that depending on the pigmentation of your skin and what race you are, what your culture is, you are inherently privileged or underprivileged, and no matter if you aren't racist, it's still there, subconsciously in you. And it's going on in elementary schools, sometimes as early as pre-K and kindergarten, across America. We've seen it in Florida with BLM marches. We've seen slave auction recreations that were extremely racist, and I won't even describe them, but they were made in an attempt to be woke and appealing to the leftist ideas of inclusion, and it's sad. And California is one of the worst at it. Yorba Linda has an amazing school board, and they banned critical race theory. So what happens? Cal State Fullerton, of course, my school, unfortunately, says that they're going to make sure their teachers know about critical race theory, understand it, and are well equipped to teach it and implement it in their teaching programs. And these are people that are going to go out to teach middle schools, elementary schools, and high schools one day.
No, no. They're going to be the people with the green hair we see on those videos.
Exactly. People extreme examples here and there. That's not the case. It's more widespread than people think.
Yeah. You know, and the sad part about that is, they never take into account the kids and the people who got it the hard way. You know, they earned it. They worked. They took odd jobs to earn money to go to college, and nothing was handed to them. But they get bunched in. You know, they get thrown in with the same crowd that you're now. You're privileged. You're not privileged. Yeah. You earned it. And that's the part that I think is especially sad when kids do step up and take responsibility and earn the right to be there, and then they get there and they find out, well, you're privileged.
Exactly. Yeah, and I can't imagine how my life would be if, when I was growing up as a young kid, if I was told, oh, because I am a dark-skinned Latino man, that I am inherently going to be underprivileged in America, that all the white individuals around me have a leg up on me, and I will never be as good at them because of the systematic racism in America. I can't imagine what that would have done to me, coming from a very poor background of immigrant parents to where I am now. I wonder what type of psychological effect that would have on me. Mm-hmm. Would I have been eager to work on my circumstances, go and serve my country with pride, get an education, or would I have just been in this perpetual sense of, I'll never be great because the system is against me?
Exactly.
And it's extremely dangerous, and it's disgusting, quite honestly. I will always say that people who subscribe to the idea of CRT and push these ideas are truly the racists, because either one, they think minorities are underprivileged and they need a lower standard in math and education and help us because we can't help ourselves, or because they think that all white people, no matter who they are racist. And last time I checked, if you classify all people as one thing, you're basically following the same thing as any other racist, and that is wrong.
Yeah. As a minority person, to hear that, it's got to be just so, I don't know, it's just a kick in the gut to think that you're supposed to feel that way when really you don't feel that way. You feel good about who you are and where you
Absolutely.
Came from, and yet they're telling you, well, you're disadvantaged.
Well, but then any bump in the road, right? There isn't anybody who's you apply for a job and you don't get it. Well, you don't get it, and you don't get it, so you go to the next one.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that big a deal, but if you've been kind of programmed for all that time, it's like, oh, I know why I didn't get
exactly.
the job.
So, right.
And I'm not the first person to come up with this. People much smarter than me, like Charlie Kirk and Douglas Murray, talk about this a lot. But they say there is a supply and demand problem in the United States when it comes to racism. We have a large demand for it and a low supply for it.
That is pretty funny. That's totally true.
We regurgitate this lies about systematic racism and push it into kids as little as elementary school, sometimes even younger. And it's a shame, especially here in California, when a majority of our kids are not even up to standards in English, math, or science. So
right.
They're more worried about teaching wokeism than they are teaching them English, math, and science, things that will actually affect their future and their outcomes of not only those kids, but our entire state and nation.
Yeah. And you look at, you look at the kids that are just the white kids, your run-of-the-mill white kids. Well, they're told that they have all these privileges. Well, I guess, when you're a kid, you're not a real, I mean, children sometimes do say things that are sort of philosophical, but children are not philosophers.
No.
And so they're not thinking about the wider implication of that. But if you're told that all the time, you're thinking, well, I can sit down and slide uphill.
Yeah.
I'm not going to have to do anything.
Yeah,
this is all going to
exactly.
This is all going to fall right on me. And I thought, it's a bad message. Nobody wins in that message, actually.
Exactly. Yeah, and there are ways to fix it. I mean, Florida has been very strongly against it.
Yeah.
They have the great Governor DeSantis there. And although we may not be under such a lucky leadership as DeSantis, we have someone a little bit worse, to say the least, Newsom. There are other leaders that we can affect. You know, there's Tony Thurmond. He's the superintendent of public instruction in California. I can tell you right now, they're not doing anything to stop this. They wouldn't dare lift their fingers against the unions that are giving them millions. They wouldn't dare to question the leftist agenda. And that's why I personally am really hoping for Lance Christensen to be the next superintendent of public instruction. I mean, that's someone who's worried about getting the education fixed first. It's someone who's advocated for school choice in the past, which should be a right that actually helps minorities the most out of anything we can do policy-wise right here, right now in California. I mean, and that's how you really move the nation forward. Instead of telling everyone they're underprivileged, and if you're white, you're racist, no matter what you actually hold in your heart, it's inherently there, subconsciously or consciously. No, we need someone like Lance Christensen to focus on education and tell kids, hey, we got to learn how to do 2 + 2 before we learn white and white equals ultimate racist. Like, we can't be doing those type of things. And truly, I mean, I'm excited for that. I think those are type of things that make me hopeful, like I mentioned before, an optimist, that we do have good candidates running like Lance and many others who can make changes in their respective circles and spheres of influence and change a lot of that craziness that we're seeing, especially here in California.
Well, it's interesting too, like in the, we didn't want to leave today without what you're seeing in Southern California, what the prevailing sentiment is about what's going on the border.
In the Hispanic conservative Hispanic groups that you meet with, what's the sentiment there?
Well, I can tell you quite honestly, it's not necessarily a top concern for the Hispanic community. They are really worried about the economy and the jobs, and they're really worried about crime.
Yeah, and that's another little thing too.
On, right. Is that some of this crime, and a good chunk of it, is made worse by our open border crisis.
Right.
You have cartels operating in Northern California. You have cartels operating in Los Angeles. You have cartels operating in San Bernardino County in the Inland Empire, which is where I'm from. And you have cartels operating in San Diego and along the border. And these are not good people. And they're pushing in fentanyl that's killing people left and right.
Mm-hmm.
And should be declared a complete emergency. But, of course, if you do that and you talk about the border, next thing you know, the progressives are calling you racist. So you can't
right.
do that. You just have to let people die instead, apparently, according to the Democrat Party and their actions thus far. So they're really worried about the economy and crime. But it does play into the border crisis. They go hand in hand, unfortunately, because when you have widespread drug addiction, that's going to increase crime. That's how you get those petty crimes like the catalytic converters being stolen, you know, petty theft of properties at stores. It's a domino effect that we can stop at the source. And it's just about explaining that to people, because most people, when they think the border, like, oh, they just don't want to let people in, or, you know, they just want stronger security. We get that, but it's not our primary concern. When you explain how much of a serious cause and effect it has on their communities, then they start to realize, okay, this is a problem.
Yeah.
And I'm of the mind, I think, like many conservatives nowadays are, that we need immigration reform very soon, and something that's actually going to work. We need to vet people correctly. We need to get people to come here, correctly, the right way, so they can, you know, be fruitful in their endeavors. But we can't have it ramp into legal immigration.
No.
It's not okay. It's not possible. And we are a nation of law and order. And we need to protect our sovereignty and our borders.
Well, another thing. If we followed
our own laws, it'd be fun to just say, like, hey, let's follow our own laws, the ones we have.
Yeah,
let's follow those
ones
for a year and see what happens.
Well, I think it's terribly unfair to the folks that came here legally, that went through the system, that waited years to get that piece of paper that says they're a citizen, something they can be proud of, and then you have the group that just comes across.
Yeah.
I would think that would just incense people, that they did it the right way, and heck, they should have just waited.
Absolutely.
They did it the right way, and they're having a job, and they're struggling, and these other guys are rolling in, getting handed a cell phone. And
we can't forget that in California, they gave them their own stimulus check out of the American taxpayer pocket. Unbelievable. You know, a majority of them may not be paying taxes. I can guarantee you that not everyone who received the stimulus check has paid their taxes in the past. Many do, but it's definitely not all of them, right? And then you have the possibility of, you know, President Biden thinking about giving them separation pay if they were separated. Giving them more money than I would have received if I died while serving my country.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was more than U.S. service members get from their life insurance.
Yeah, when I heard that, I mean, it was crazy. That was absolutely crazy.
Yeah, that's like, you can't You can't actually think that's going to work. We have to take a really quick break, but our guest today is Marco Salata Rodas, and he is he's working in Southern California. I don't know if that's for the most part. We're going to find out when we come back. We should find out what other things he's working on before suddenly we're out of time, because I feel that happening. It's going fast today.
Yeah, it is.
Weird. So you'll be able to find the commercial-free archive on this later this afternoon. It's May the 22nd, 2022, and we're at wethepeopleradio.us. Nice job.
Give a man a free house and he'll bust out the windows, put his family on food stamps. Now he's a big spender, no food on the table, and the bills ain't paid, cause he's spending on cigarettes and PGA. They'll turn us all into beggars, cause they're easier to please. They're feeding our people that government cheese.
Well, the eagle's been flying slow, and the flag's been flying low, and a lot of people saying that America's fixing to fall. But speaking just for me, and some people from Tennessee, we got a thing or two to tell you all. This lady may have stumbled, but she ain't never failed. And if the Russians don't believe that, they can all go straight to hell. We're gonna put her feet back on the paths of righteousness, and then God bless America again. And you never did think that it ever would happen again. In America, did you? You never did think that we'd ever get together again. We're damn sure food, you were walking real proud, and we're talking real loud again. In America, you never did think that it ever would happen again.
And then we elected Joe.
Sleepy Joe.
Oh, I forgot that had Russians in it. I was like, oh, it's kind of timely. So on a wider, kind of the wider conservative politics side, what do you see happening this year?
Well, I am very confident the red wave is coming. I believe that Republicans have a tremendous chance this coming election cycle to capitalize on the mistakes of the Democrats, and as you mentioned, our not-so-great Sleepy Joe, and really show the American people that under conservative leadership, with the principles of conservative values, America is more efficient and is more greater than without it. And I do see a red wave coming, and I'm really excited to see it.
Well, that's kind of nice. So when you guys go to Turning Point, I know, speaks on campuses and things. Are you kind of part of that? Are you involved in that part of it?
Yes. So when Turning Point does events, it's a variety. Students table on campus almost weekly with posters, and they talk to students, and they try to find conservative students or like-minded students who are interested in learning more or hold those values and didn't know they existed. And they bring them in, and they create a strong, almost like a family on a campus of conservative students who can speak out because they are together instead of being isolated amongst a sea of leftists all alone. And they hold speaking events. So I've been super grateful to have been asked to speak at a few universities. We've had great speakers come to Kelsey Fullerton, like Charlie Kirk and many others. And they do that throughout the nation, and they just help bring the ideas to the echo chamber that are universities.
Well, do you find, I mean, because what we hear, right, we're only catching what gets reported, but, you know, we're hearing that it's almost impossible for you guys to do that, and you get protested, and it's a big, you know, you're basically shut out all the time.
Sure, that is a very common problem, but nothing really is impossible. And if you don't accept defeat, and if you refuse to stand down, most of the time they don't know what to do. When you take the threat of protest and laugh at it, and then post about it, making jokes about them for it, they don't know how to act. I mean, I've had people say that they were going to protest an event we did at Cal State Fullerton. And it was hilarious. And I retweeted them. And I said, have fun. I hope you have a good time. And they just don't know how to act when you're unafraid. Now, I've been blessed because I am a veteran. So I really do see it as a mission that, you know, I will die for in a sense. And quite honestly, to save my country and promote conservative values, I mean, if someone takes me out, it would be worth it. It's better that than being quiet. But I tell my students all the time, you know, you have to shout it from the rooftops. You have to be strong and proud about who you are and what you believe in, because conservative values aren't hateful values. They're actually the values that care the most about people and their rights and their well-being and economic futures. That's just a fact. The Democrat Party does not care about those things, even though they say they do.
I think their recent stand on abortion has pretty much sealed their fate there.
Right, exactly. So, and if they tell you to stop yelling, well, you start talking, and if they tell you you can't do that, well, you grab a sign and you start walking in circles. And if they take out your legs, you start crawling. And if they, you know, take you out more, well, then you're holding the sign with your jaw if you have to. But you don't stop. And that's the idea. And Turning Point USA students really do have that mentality of fighting extremely hard, being unafraid. And, of course, it takes some time, but once you have a good chapter, which many universities do, they do not back down. I mean, there could be 500 people outside protesting, and they're inside having a blast, convincing people who are moderate or empowering students who are already conservative. And like I said, today I am speaking on my own, but I truly do have a lot of admiration for Turning Point USA, and I've been extremely grateful for my time with them.
Well, you know, I guess it's just an opportunity for us to learn a little bit about it, because we get little snippets out in the world, and, you know, let's face it, the bulk of people are not in college, so we're not, you know, we're not part of that. So for all the people out there that really want to support that mission, you know, I mean, if you're more comfortable with that, we get a, you know, we'd love to have somebody on from that to just do a pitch and build some support. But what's
absolutely. Well, I mean, if people want more information or they just want to donate $5 because they like the idea and what we're doing, they can go to tpusa.com at any time to donate or learn more. We have a bunch of conferences for students. We have the Young Women's Leadership Summit coming up. We have the Student Action Summit coming up. And that's really where students are motivated and engaged, and they leave with a sense of understanding of how important the fight is and a motivation that is unlike anything else I've ever seen in my life. And they take that to their universities and colleges across America and fight for good causes.
That's awesome. I'll put a link on the page for today so people can get a look at that. But I mean, you have to really be living in a hole not to have ever heard of Turning Point USA. But do you know what they do? Do you know how to help them? I mean, that's all very different.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of great organizations. I mean, there's a lot of good causes in California. I mean, we have churches getting motivated and fighting back against the left like I have never seen before, at least in my lifetime. We have, again, I've been blessed to work with the Republican National Hispanic Assembly, truly helping candidates understand the Hispanic American community, engaging the Hispanic American communities in places where traditionally the right has not been in. And it's because we understand Latinos are conservative, and we're going to keep fighting to show them the truth that the Democrats are not for them. They're against them. They just use them for identity politics and their numbers. And we just have so many great causes. Like I said, Lance Christensen running for office. We have, I mean, amongst many other amazing candidates. It's a good
time. Let's
right
not gloss that over. That, so if you're looking at your ballot, that is state superintendent of schools, Lance Christensen. And the good part is he's the guy at the top of the ticket, or, you know, top of the list. So that makes it easy.
That's right. Yeah. And that's starting there with our education system will help a lot. And then supporting great causes like the RNHA, Turning Point USA, getting involved with your local GOP. I mean, this is how we make changes happen and make that red wave come, like I was mentioning earlier.
I think it's an important thing for people to hear from folks like you, because what happens, you know, you're constantly bombarded with this race thing, and the danger is people just shut down on it. So they just, you know what I mean? They stop engaging. It's like, I'm just gonna get filleted if I go there. And that's just basically not true. It sounds like the folks you're dealing with are all, they're looking for a more productive country. They're looking for a future. This isn't all about tearing the place to the ground.
I mean, I've had incidents where a young leftist at my college, or at my university, better said, flipped me off, called me ugly, said I was terrible, all for handing out informational pamphlets on the known communist Angela Davis, who came to speak at my university. She went from that to 30 minutes crying in my arms because she felt bad about the way she was acting. And that's part because we don't act like they do. And every day I pray that President Joe Biden all of a sudden comes to this realization that what he's doing is not the best, all of a sudden becomes completely capable of finishing sentences and fixes our country and does great things. Because truthfully, I don't want our president to fail.
No.
I don't want anyone in a position of leadership to fail. And I want these leftists to realize what they're doing is wrong, and these ideas aren't helping anyone but themselves, because being a victim is part of their identity, and being woke and who can outwoke each other is part of how they get validation because of their own issues at home and in themselves. I pray for all these people. I want them to do good. But until they do, we have to take the mantle and talk about the truth with conviction, with strength, but with love at the same time. And that's how we can change people's minds and show them that the Republican Party isn't this racist, terrible thing that the left says about us, because they know if they instill fear in them, they'll never trust or listen to us. And rather, that we're the party that wants to help them the most with economic opportunities, jobs, liberties, constitutional rights, and a better tomorrow for everyone, regardless of what you look like or what background you have. And that's quite honestly the truth. And you can't back down, because until they realize that on their own, you need to be as strong as possible in your ideas. And that doesn't mean you have to be like the amazing Bill and Aaron here that I'm talking to, or like myself, and
go out
and talk about this weekly and be out there and outspoken. Sometimes it's as simple as talking to your neighbors, talking to your family, you know, talking to your church and telling them we need to get more involved if we believe in these biblical views. Little things or big things, but you play your part. And that's how we can change and fix America.
Yeah. Well, you're right, because the biggest danger with people who would agree with us on these types of things is that they're sitting back and going, it doesn't matter. There's voter fraud. The left is just going to stuff the ballot box or whatever their thing is. And then they say, it doesn't matter. I'm not going to vote. And
You need to be involved.
which is why we still have Gavin Newsom. I mean, They signed the petitions to put the recall on the ballot, but then they didn't go to the ballot box to vote. And then I have a lot of people who turn around and say, well, they cheated. And I'm like, well, did you vote? Well, no, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, wait a minute. Like, how hard do they have to cheat if you don't actually vote?
Right. Even if you believe that the cheating occurred, and there's a lot of evidence that say it did happen, at least in many pockets of America.
Yeah, no argument.
It wasn't ballot harvesting necessarily. It wasn't because they threw away your vote. In California,
but go make them cheat.
Vote, and you can track it online. And if something happens, contact the right people, contact the voter register office, contact your GOP office, and they'll find out. And you might even be helping us get closer to a better, more safe, and legitimate election.
Well, I found out a couple of weeks ago that the California GOP has attorneys in all 58 counties that will be watching for election problems. And I thought, wow, well, that's something that's not being talked about.
Yeah, go vote, track it. Something suspicious comes up, give them a call. And that's how we can do our part and hopefully have some very good outcomes in California at the local and statewide level.
Well, I've always felt that the Hispanic community was the most aligned with American values.
I'm a little biased, but I would agree so.
Yeah, I mean, well, when you come down to the basic things, they're the, you know, just culturally, right? Culturally, I don't know. Most of us are, we're Catholics. A lot of the Hispanic community is Catholic. So these are people who don't believe in abortion. These are people who believe in helping the poor, but not just giving everything away. I mean, they have a good work ethic. They real strong family. All these things, and it's never made any sense to me that would be a strong, strong arm of the left. That's
absolutely.
That's just always like, what are they telling these people that's convincing
and
them to join?
I have to thank you both very much for not calling us Latinx, because
calling you what?
If you're Latinx, I'm not sure if you've heard of that.
Yeah, I don't understand the X stuff.
Look,
I'm kind of X stupid
myself, and I'm supposed to identify it as it. Apparently,
what does it mean?
So I thank you for not calling us the made up leftist names and acronyms they make for us.
Well, but what is a Latinx? What does that mean?
I've heard two different theories. One of them is that it's for Latinos who don't identify fully as American, but don't identify fully as where the parents come from.
Oh, yeah. It's our identification. I should have known. Well, I'm double
yeah,
mind.
And the other thing is it's a queer inclusive, LGBTQ inclusive.
Oh, yeah, that's terrific.
Rewording of the word Latina or Latino.
Yeah, yeah. I don't really get
the
that.
Dams of the world and such. Mm.
Well, that's just...
That does not use it, believe me. It's only used by white elitists in the university systems, white leftists, and some misguided leftist Latinos.
Yeah. We don't really even know those people, so... and we don't spend our time feeding the bears, so we don't allow those people to come on and talk to us, so we don't learn anything from them either.
Yeah, they're all around us. At my university, they have a Latinx center. And,
oh, very brother. God bless you and your work. We're really happy to have you on today. It's been fun. And for all the people out there, you know, around the country and outside the country, it's always good to know that everything isn't what you think it is, you know. Yeah. So keep up the good work. We really appreciate you.
Yes, thank you. No, we have to remain hopeful in God. America has stormed many battles and waters before, and we will continue to do so with great people.
Absolutely.
Just doing their part, getting out to vote, and helping to fight America in their own little way every day.
Amen. And thank you very much for your service in the military. And Marcos, if you have any other people who are just not getting any airtime and have a good message, you send them to us. We'd love to hear from
Absolutely.
Them.
Absolutely.
Thank you
so much, Aaron and Bill. God bless.
Thanks for coming on.
All right, coming back with Sheriff Mike Johnson, and you're listening to We the People. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.